coke. I don't know where he came from. I turned around and...
Moody jerked his head up again.
Did you hear that?
He asked. No, I didn't hear anything. Again, we stood in silence. The midday sun beat down on the roof and wall of the barn, heating the air inside, turning it thick and stagnant around us. Sweat trickled in thin rivulets down my face. I strained to listen, but heard nothing. What happened when Toke saw you?
I told him something's wrong with Angel. Instead of doing anything about it, he took to hitting me. He was pissed and screaming. He had a coil of rope and was hitting me in the face with it. He was yelling that he was going to kill me. He was saying that he told me to never set foot on his property and he was going to beat me to death.
Did he see Angel there?
He had to. I don't know how he could miss her. I fell back against the wall and he threw the rope down and started hitting me with his fists. He kept hitting me. Then I remember my hand knocked against something hard hanging on the wall. It was a gear or a flywheel or something. I just remember grabbing it and swinging it. I hit Toke in the head.
Moody tossed the uneaten half of his sandwich into the bag and dropped it to the ground.
I didn't mean to hit him that hard. He was trying to kill me. I just hit him the once, that's all. He fell back and was lying on his stomach, but he was breathing.
What happened next?
I didn't know what to do. I dug around in Toke's pocket and found his cell phone. I dialed 911 and put the phone beside him. I figured they'd come help Angel and him both.
You left them there?
No, I sat beside Angel until I heard a car coming.
Did you carry her to the house?
Carry her to the house?
Moody looked at me like I had stumped him with my question.
Why would I do that? They might not find her. I sat by her side until they came.
Until who came?
I didn't see who it was. I heard the sound of a vehicle coming up the highway. There was no siren. When I saw the headlights on the treetops, I took off.
Your fingerprints will be on that gear. They know it's the murder weapon.
I'm not stupid, he said. When I was waiting for help to arrive, I wiped off the phone and that gear with an oil rag.
Why'd you run? It was self-defense. Moody gave me a half-smile.
I'm a lynch,
was all he said. A snap of a twig made us both freeze to listen. I looked at him, and he started to shake his head no, when both the front and back door of the barn exploded open.
Get on the ground! On the ground! Now!
I could see Nathan charging through the back door, and Jeb and Sheriff Kimball at the front. There were four other law officers in their company, all wearing black Kevlar vests and helmets.
I said, get on the fucking ground! Now!
Nathan shouted. Moody looked up at the hayloft where his gun lay, because of me. I went to my knees in the hope that he would follow. He hesitated, then went down on his knees, his hands in the air. I went belly down in the dirt and watched him do the same. Nathan ran up and put his knee on Moody's back.
I'm not talking,
Moody said, grunting.
I want a lawyer.
Nathan cranked a pair of handcuffs around Moody's wrists, his knee now pressing Moody's face into the ground, the dirt sticking to the boy's sweat, his eyes on fire with rage, staring at me. Chapter 33. How'd you find me? I asked Jeb from my seat in the back of his squad car, my hands cuffed behind my back. I thought about asking where he was taking me, but I already knew.
Your cell phone, Jeb said. At 1 o'clock, you got a call, remember?
I remembered. I had just stepped out of the car. There was no one there, I said.
That was our dispatcher calling you. When you called 911 yesterday because your brother was lost, you created a link between your phone and the dispatcher. Once that connection is made, dispatch can call back and we can locate your phone. It's a handy piece of technology. You wouldn't believe how many times we get assault calls that get cut off. The system is designed so we can call back, use GPS to locate the scene if we need to.
It was a dirty trick, I said.
Moody's wanted for murder. I couldn't let you go through with your scheme. Had to protect you, Joe.
So why am I in handcuffs? What did I do?
Sheriff Kimball wants to talk to you. Kind of a debriefing.
You have Moody, I said. You can debrief him.
You heard him yelling that he wants a lawyer, didn't you?
Maybe I want a lawyer, too. Am I under arrest? Jeb paused to think that one over, and something churned in my stomach.
That's still up in the air.
We arrived at the sheriff's office, and Jeb escorted me in, still in handcuffs, and put me in a room with thick steel doors on either end. A visiting room for lawyers and inmates, I assumed. The table was bolted to the floor and the plastic chairs were non-lethal. They left me alone for almost an hour before anyone came in to debrief me. I assumed the delay was to let me stew and maybe scare me, but all it did was make me mad. When they finally came in, Nathan Calder led the way, sitting across from me and placing a digital recorder in the middle of the table. You mind taking these handcuffs off me? I said. They're starting to chafe.
You have bigger problems than a little irritation on your wrists, Nathan said.
Sheriff Kimball also sat down at the table, and Jeb hung back by the door, his arms folded across his chest with a look on his face that let me know we were not friends at the moment. I could see that Nathan was going to be the bad cop, but as I looked around the room, I didn't see a good cop.
What did Moody Lynch say to you in that barn?
Nathan asked. You should go ask him, I said.
I'm asking you, Nathan said.
When I didn't answer, he added,
You ever hear of aiding an offender?
I've heard of it, but chose to play dumb. As a reporter, I sometimes walked a fine line between getting information and obstructing an investigation. I had taken great pains to know the legal limits, and was pretty sure I hadn't crossed any lines. Aiding an offender? What's that? Nathan smiled.
If someone obstructs an investigation by helping someone who committed a crime, that person is guilty of a felony.
Well, it's a good thing that I didn't aid an offender, I said.
Oh, you aided Moody. We know that well enough. The question is, do you want to get your ass out of the sling?
And exactly how does my having a conversation with Moody Lynch rise to the level of aiding him?
You brought him food.
On the inside, I screamed, fuck! On the outside, I was doing everything I could do to keep my face in check. I brought Moody a sandwich. I gave food to a fugitive. I thought back to my memory of the statute. Can giving a fugitive a sandwich constitute aiding? I think it can. At that moment, I fully intended to tell them everything they wanted to know. I mean, why keep it a secret? I made it clear to Moody that I was there to get his story out, and he had given me facts that contradicted the official version. I could help his cause. So what if it looked like I was doing it to save my own skin? I opened my mouth to speak when a new thought flashed by, one that painted a thin smile on my face. They were bluffing. No one had come to take my fingerprints. I thought back to the sandwich bag, plastic, with loops in the top for a handle. The clerk handed the bag to me using the handle. Did I ever hold it by the side? Did I leave a fingerprint on it? I don't think so. They never asked me for a fingerprint sample. That meant that they didn't find usable prints on the bag. I paid with cash and didn't keep the receipt. With Moody not talking, they had no way to prove I gave Moody the food. It was a bluff. What food? I asked.
Don't treat us like we're stupid, Calder said. We know you brought him those sandwiches.
I feigned indignation. You have me handcuffed here for an hour because you think I brought Moody Lynch a sandwich? Now it was my turn to bluff. I'm going to have one hell of a story to write about this. I didn't come to Buckley in search of an article, but you just gave me one. The worry showed on Kimball's face, but Calder kept his composure.
Are you denying that you took sandwiches to Moody?
I'm saying you're making shit up. Am I under arrest for something? If so, lock me up. If not, take these handcuffs off me. Kimball exchanged a look with Jeb, and then nodded. Jeb came around the table digging his key out, and undid the cuffs. You didn't need to threaten me, I said, rubbing the rings on my wrists. Moody knew I was going to tell you what he told me, but now I'm not so sure. I made a point of displaying my injury. Jeb, who was standing by the door again, said,
Joe, this is a murder investigation. We need to know what Moody said.
I'll tell you, I said, but only if you let me see Toke's autopsy report.
Out of the question, Calder said. We don't share those kinds of facts.
You're still a possible suspect in all this.
That's bullshit, and you know it, I said.
You want what I got? Then I get to look at the autopsy report.
Why?
Jeb asked.
That's my business, I answered.
Do we have a deal? Kimball nodded toward the door, and the three of them left. I sighed my relief in short breaths so that the surveillance camera didn't pick up on my doubt. After 10 minutes, they came back in, Kimball carrying the report. He dropped it on the table in front of me.
This is off the record, he said. Agreed?
Agreed, I said. I paged through the report, pausing for a minute on the autopsy photos. I'd seen pictures like that before, so I was prepared. But this was my father, possibly. For some reason, that made it different. The crime scene pictures showed him lying on his stomach against the barn wall where Vicky had shown me the blood. His eyes were open and staring into the dirt. The curve of his skull had been interrupted where the bone had been caved in. Next to his head lay a metal gear about the size of a bread plate. And next to that, the oil rag that Moody had used to wipe off his fingerprints. I turned to the next page and found a report that explained the cause of death. The medical examiner cataloged 3 separate locations on the skull where Toke had been bludgeoned with a heavy object. The wounds were consistent with the gear found at the scene, and the gear contained visible hair, skin, and bone fragments, making it the likely murder weapon. I closed the file. First, I said, Moody gave a version of events that is inconsistent with your theory of the case. Kimball leaned in, as if I had piqued his interest. Moody admits he went to Toke's barn. He went there because Angel sent him a text that she was freaking out. But after that, everything is different. My understanding is that Angel was found in the house. I looked at Jeb, who had given me that piece of information. But Moody said that she was in the barn when he got there. He also said that she was acting groggy, consistent with an overdose. If he's right, the overdose happened before the murder.
If you believe Moody Lynch,
Calder said with a measure of contempt. I threw a cold look at Nathan.
You wanted to know what Moody said?
Well, I'm telling you what he said. What you do with that is up to you.
Let him talk,
Kimball interjected. Moody said he was trying to give aid to Angel when Toke came up behind him and started beating him with a coil of rope. You saw the bruises on his face, right? Moody said he hit Toke with the gear in self-defense. But he only hit him one time.
He admitted he hit Toke with a gear?
Jeb asked. The gear was on the wall, I said. When Toke was hitting him, Moody fell against the wall, grabbed the gear, and hit Toke.
Did Moody actually say that he only hit Toke once, or is that what you interpreted?
Nathan asked. We were in the middle of that conversation when you guys came rushing in, but he said he hit Toke once, and Toke fell to the ground.
I suppose he didn't want to admit that he crushed Toke's skull in,
Calder said. It was Moody who called 911, I said. Toke was unconscious, but he was breathing, at least according to Moody.
According to Moody,
Calder repeated. Moody used Toke's phone to call 911. He didn't say anything to the dispatcher. He just dialed the number and waited. You tell me, did the 911 call come in like that? I pretended as if Jeb hadn't already told me those details. If it happened that way, it corroborates Moody's story. How would he know that there was a silent 911 call unless he made it?
That doesn't mean he didn't kill Toke, Nathan said. He called 911 because of Angel, that's all.
But what was Angel doing in the barn, and how did she get back into the house?
Moody took her to the house before we arrived, Jeb said.
Moody said he stayed in the barn until he saw headlights coming. Why would he lie about that? Why not just say he took her into the house to wait?
Because she was never in the barn, you moron,
Calder said.
Moody went to the barn to kill Toke. He killed Toke and left. That's all there is to it.
Then he wouldn't have known about the overdose, would he, you moron? Nathan started to stand up, the heat of his contempt burning holes in his britches. Kimball put a hand on the deputy's arm.
Nathan, let me handle this. Maybe you should step outside.
Calder gave Kimball a double take and then looked at me with a scowl. After he left, Kimball said,
Is there anything else you can tell us? Anything else that Moody said that might be relevant?
No. Like I said, we were just getting going when you guys came in. but Sheriff, for what it's worth, I believe him.
That's fine, Kimball said, dismissing my opinion.
He shut the recorder off and took it with him when he got up to leave.
I'm free to go?
I asked.
You are,
Kimball said, and he walked out, leaving Jeb and me alone. I'll need a ride to go get my car, I said to Jeb. He rolled his eyes.
I'm not a taxi service.
No, but you did arrest me for no good reason, and that's why I'm here, and my car's out in the middle of nowhere. Come on, give me a ride.
Fine,
he said with another roll of his eyes. This time, he let me ride in the front seat with no shackles. The ride was quiet for the most part. He asked me a lot of the same questions that Calder had asked me already, and I gave the same answers. It wasn't until he had parked behind my car and I was about to get out that he brought up a new topic.
Before you go, he said, there's something you should know.
Yeah, what's that?
Back when you gave that DNA sample, we expedited it. Sheriff Kimball thought you might actually be a suspect.
And?
The results came back this morning.
And? I said again, with a little more irritation in my voice.
And what?
I gave him a stop messing with me look.
Okay, fine. It turns out that you are definitely Toke Talbert's son.
Chapter 34. I was a millionaire. Well, I was about to become one. It amazed me how the thought of getting free money like that could change a man's perspective. It was as if the wet cement I'd been trudging through suddenly hardened beneath my feet, and I could sprint in any direction I chose. I could feel the contours of a world that had always existed beyond my reach. Ideas pinged and ricocheted in my head so fast that I had to pull my car over and let my thoughts clear. I gripped my steering wheel and tightened just about every muscle in my body, pulling the energy and excitement all up into my chest and squeezing it there until a shrill screech escaped through my clenched teeth. Then I took a few deep breaths and tried to calm down. One thing at a time, I thought. I need to get a handle on what this means. What are the mechanics of a probate? How does one start such a process? I decided that it would be wise to pay another visit to Bob Mullen. Maybe I could get some of the paperwork going while I was still in town. I drove to Bob's house, the beautiful Victorian, across from his office, and rang the bell. I could see a ceiling fan churning inside and hear a hint of music seeping through an open window, so I assumed that he was home. I rang it a second time and was about to ring a third when he called to me, standing on a sidewalk that ran around the side of the house. Mr. Mullen, do you have a second?
I suppose I do.
The DNA test came back, I blurted out. I'm Toke's biological son. His eyes lit up, but only for a second. Then his face took on the look of a chess player thinking past his next move. He stroked his beard and let his mouth curve down in thought.
I'm glad you stopped by, he said. I have something I'd like to talk about. Come this way.
We followed the walkway, which took us to his backyard, an impressive space dotted with maple trees and pine. In the middle of it all, a paver stone patio surrounded a fire pit and held some Adirondack chairs. A woman sat in one of the chairs working a crossword puzzle. She had long silver hair, and I recognized her from the picture in Bob's office as his wife. Bob gestured for me to sit in one of the chairs.
You brought company, the woman said.
Sarah, this is Joe Talbert Jr. Joe, this is my wife, Sarah.
Sarah gave me a warm smile and said,
It's very nice to meet you, Joe. Would you like some tea?
I was about to say no when Bob said,
Some tea would be lovely. I'll get it.
Don't be silly, she said. I'm perfectly capable of carrying a little tea.
It took Sarah some effort to rise to her feet, and Bob lent her an arm. Once up, she seemed steady. She gave Bob a pat on his hand and departed for the house. After she'd gone, he took a seat in the chair next to me. I had come there with 1,000 questions that I wanted to throw at Bob, questions that all led to the same final point. How do I get my money? But Bob had something heavy on his mind, something more serious than my game show winnings, so I waited for him to start. He leaned forward to rest his elbows on his knees.
Joe, I want to tell you some things, but before I do, I need to know that you will never reveal what I have to say. I need your word on that.
His solemn tone sobered me right up. I leaned forward to mirror his posture and to better hear his whispery voice. I promise to keep this conversation a secret, I said. He nodded.
As you know, I worked for the State Department for several years. In that time, I made a lot of friends and personal connections. People who know how to get information, if you know what I mean.
I nodded my understanding.
Well, after you told me about Charlie Talbert's partner getting killed in a fire, I had a good friend of mine look into it. Turns out, there was an investigation, but no charges ever came from it. They found evidence of an accelerant, so they knew that it was arson. But the question had been, who set the fire? It started in the upstairs office, and they found Charlie's partner dead at the bottom of the stairs with a crack in his skull. Kind of looked like the partner doused the place with gas and fell down the steps after striking the match.
What about Charlie?
He had an alibi. Not a good one, but good enough that it muddied things up.
You don't believe him?
It's not my call. But my friend spoke with the investigator on that case, and they don't believe him. The office had a sprinkler system, and they found traces of epoxy on one of the sprinkler heads. Sprinkler heads are heat-activated. They have solder that melts when the temperature gets hot enough. The right kind of glue might keep the solder from melting, slow things down, or maybe even stop the sprinkler from working altogether. That epoxy would have taken some time to dry, and the partner had just gotten back from a trip the afternoon of the fire. Also, the partner had no smoke damage in his lungs or esophagus. That means he died before the smoke got to him.
Charlie killed him?
That's the thing. None of this proves that Charlie was involved. The partner could have put epoxy on the sprinkler head days before, and they don't know how long the man lay at the bottom of those steps before he died. It could have been a minute or two, in which case he could have set the fire. Or he could have lain there for 20 minutes while Charlie sloshed gasoline around the place. In the end, though, Charlie never got charged, and he was the sole beneficiary of the insurance policy. $1.5 million.
Can you use this to stop Charlie from becoming Angel's guardian?
Not a word of it. It's technically still an open investigation. What I just told you is confidential information. It will never find its way into any background study on Charlie. On paper, he looks like a white knight riding in to save the day. I spoke to Miriam Baker, who's doing his background study, and she's completely gaga over the prospect of Charlie becoming Angel's guardian. He's got the judge on his side, too. Hell, the whole town has fallen in love with this guy. I've never seen such a concerted effort to fast-track the appointment of a guardian.
Charlie's a conniving prick, I said. Bob smiled at that one.
Not only that, but he has everyone convinced that you are a violent, irresponsible gold digger. The word at the courthouse is that you're only here to cash in on the Hicks money. Miriam is telling everyone that she saw you beat up Harley Redding down at the Snipe's Nest, and that you lost your own autistic brother.
That son of a bitch, I said. He's been undercutting me this whole time.
The man knows how to work the system,
Bob said. But he won't hurt Angel. If he becomes her guardian, I mean, he can only get at her money if she lives, right? Bob leaned back in his chair, crossing one knee over the other.
Charlie's smart. If he becomes her guardian, he'll have control over her interests until she turns 18. But there's a good chance that Angel will have cognitive issues when she comes out of her coma. If she comes out of her coma. In either case, Charlie could have control of her inheritance for life. But I don't think that's good enough for Charlie.
What do you mean?
On Friday, Charlie's lawyer filed adoption papers. Charlie's going to adopt Angel.
He can't do that, can he?
I think he can. Angel's 14. At 14, the child doesn't need to consent to the adoption. And with her being in a coma, that part is settled. The only consent they would need would be that of the guardian. And Charlie's going to be the guardian. I suppose the court could put the brakes on if the judge had any concerns, but Charlie's got them all hoodwinked.
But how is being her adoptive father any different than being her guardian? Either way, he'll siphon her money away.
Bob looked at me with the seriousness of a hangman and said,
As her adoptive father, he inherits all of her assets if she dies.
You think that he might kill her?
He'll make it look like an accident or natural causes, but yes. I think Charlie would kill Angel to get at her money. Charlie puts on a big show, but my source tells me that he's a huge gambler and is in debt up to his neck. His whole life's an act. He needs that money. And if he killed his partner to get a big payday, why not a girl he's never met before?
Can you stop him? My words sounded weak and impotent, even to me.
No, but I think you can.
Bob paused, waiting for me to catch up, but I didn't see it.
Joe, you have to become Angel's guardian.
Me? I already have a ward. I couldn't...
If you became Angel's guardian, the court would need your consent for the adoption.
I don't even know her.
But we'd have to get your petition to the court as soon as possible. Charlie's got a big head start. It's the only way.
You don't know what you're asking.
I know I'm asking a lot, especially of a young man like yourself, but Angel needs you.
I've been taking care of my brother Jeremy for nearly 6 years now. It's hard. You have no idea. Sometimes I get so frustrated I can't breathe. I feel like I've been taking care of my brother my whole life, living for him, sacrificing for him. Now you want me to take on another one?
I understand,
he said.
I really do.
I don't think you do. I stood and paced to the opposite side of the fire pit, fighting the urge to run that pulled at my legs. You've lived all over the world. You've had an exciting life. You've done what you wanted to do. I've never even been on a plane. I turned my back to Bob so that he wouldn't see my frustration tightening along the muscles of my jaw. You're asking too much of me. Bob waited for my ranting to die away. Then he said,
Can I tell you a story?
It was a rhetorical question because he launched into his story without pausing for my input.
I understand your desire to see the world. Hell, I grew up here in Buckley, but sometimes the world looks prettier from a distance.
I turned to face Bob, who had his gaze set on a patch of pines in the distance, a melancholy smile curling up on his cheeks as he gathered his thoughts.
Sarah and I dated all through high school. I think I fell in love with her before we even shared our first kiss. But like you, I had that wanderlust, and I couldn't bear the thought of staying here in Buckley, or Minnesota for that matter. It was hard, but after graduation I broke up with Sarah and set off to see the world. And I did see some amazing places, cities and countries that most people only dream about. But every time I woke up in a new bed,
every time I gazed out of my window at some view that I had dreamt of as a child, I felt, well, empty.
It didn't matter how blue the waters or how white the snow, there was always something missing. I began to realize that I was terribly unhappy, lonely. And one day, I was sitting on a balcony overlooking the Alps, trying to remember if I had ever been happy in my life, and I thought of Sarah. That's what brought me back here to Buckley. Sarah was a widow by then, and I had never married. I guess life has a funny way of working out sometimes. I don't know how to explain it, Joe, except to say that sometimes home isn't the place, it's a person. And my home had always been right here, with Sarah.
Bob pulled his gaze away from the pine trees and looked at me.
You're a young man, though. You'll have to figure these things out for yourself. Hell, back in the day, if some old fart had tried to tell me that the great out there wasn't all it was cracked up to be, I would have told him to mind his own damned business. You know the stakes. All I can ask is that you think about it before you say no.
Sarah came out of the house carrying a tea tray. But you have those great experiences, I said. That has to count for something. Bob glanced at his wife, and his disquiet seemed to melt away.
At the end of the day, Joe, only one thing counts. Everything else is just shiny baubles and empty noise.
Chapter 35. I left Bob's house more confused than when I'd arrived. Back at the motel, I sat on my bed and contemplated the enormity of what he was asking of me. Calculations of selfishness and regret and virtue all fighting to be heard. I knew what was right, but I also knew what I wanted, and those two ends remained miles apart. I pulled my phone out and considered calling Lila. Would this too be a selfish act? I wanted her opinion, but more than that, I needed her calming influence. She would know what to do, but it seemed unfair to spring this on her so close to her bar exam. As I stared at the phone, going back and forth, I noticed that I had missed a call from Allison Kress. That was all I needed. One more angry cat to toss in the gunny sack. I called her back. Hi, Allison. What's up?
Hi, Joe. I need to talk to you about something. You got a second?
I could tell by Allison's tone that the news was not going to be good. Sure, I said.
I wanted to let you know that we wrote a follow-up story to your article on Senator Dobbins.
A follow-up?
Yes, Joe. We're running a story to explain how we know about Dobbins assaulting his wife. We're going to identify the source.
But you can't do that. I gave my word.
I'm sorry, Joe. This is coming from higher up. I wrote the story myself. It'll go online Wednesday.
You'll destroy her family. Penny trusted me. You can't give her up. I won't allow it.
Joe, she said sharply, but then in a softer voice continued, Joe, you can't stop the story. The decision's been made. I'm just calling to give you the heads up.
They made the decision without even talking to me?
It's not your call.
Well, it's my call whether I'll work for an organization that would do something like this.
Joe, don't.
Allison, if you run that story, I'll have no choice but to quit.
The words came easier to me than I would have thought, and I wondered whether I would have said them at all if I didn't have the promise of $3 million in my back pocket. Maybe I wasn't meant to be a reporter. Maybe my calling would be to gather needy half-brothers and sisters to my home and take care of them. Perhaps Allison's call was what I needed to make up my mind about Angel.
I hate to hear you say that, Joe, but I understand. If I were in your shoes, I'd probably do the same thing. You're a good reporter, and I'd hate to lose you.
You've been a good boss, I said. And with that, we said our goodbyes. I looked around my empty motel room and felt the urge to be any place but there. Buckley may not have had a nightlife, but it had fresh air and sidewalks aplenty. And if that didn't do the trick, there was always the Snipe's Nest, which appealed to that small part of me that felt like basking in my imminent prosperity. As I made my way toward Main Street, I could hear the sounds of laughter and loud talking coming from a nearby park, where a group of men stood gabbing and drinking beer. I thought I could see the tail of Uncle Charlie's car parked in the line of vehicles down there. I turned and walked in the opposite direction. Half a block later, I found myself at the door to the Snipe's Nest. I peeked in before entering, just to make sure that Harley Redding wasn't inside. The bar was fairly empty of customers, which wasn't surprising, given that it was still well ahead of supper time. Vicky was leaning against the bar, studying some papers in front of her. Is the kitchen open? I asked.
Has to be, Vicky said. We can't sell beer on Sunday unless we also sell food. What do you have?
Can I get a cheeseburger basket and fries? As she relayed my order to Marv, I glanced at the paper she'd been looking at and saw that it was an application to Minnesota State University in Mankato. You're applying to college? I asked, unable to keep a big smile from stretching across my face.
Yes, I'm applying, she said with an impish grin. That doesn't mean that I'll get in or get enough financial aid to make it happen, but yes, I'm applying.
Well, that is outstanding.
I have a long way to go before this happens, if it happens, so don't get too excited.
She slid the application off the bar and picked up a clean glass.
Beer?
Sure. No, wait. You know what? I'm in the mood for something special tonight. I haven't had a Jack and Coke in forever. How about one of those?
You got it.
She scooped ice into a glass and started pouring the whiskey, letting it flow until it was more of a double.
What's the occasion?
Well, I guess I'm celebrating.
And what are you celebrating?
I'm Toke Talbert's son, I said. The DNA test came back today.
Well, hot damn and pass the gravy. I think that deserves a drink on the house.
She slid my Jack and Coke to me. Then she grabbed a bottle of vodka and started pouring a drink for herself. We clinked glasses and took a drink. The whiskey went down like butterscotch.
So what's she gonna do with all that, you know?
Inheritance? I finished her question for her. I took another pull from my drink as I gave her question some thought. I don't know. What would you do?
I'd get the hell out of Buckley, that's for sure. I mean, with that kind of scratch, you could go anywhere.
Where would you go if you could go anywhere? I asked.
Where wouldn't I go? I'd love to see Europe. Did you know there's castles in Germany where you can rent a room like it's a hotel?
I did not know that, I said. My whiskey coke tasted good. I finished it off and put my glass down so she could pour me another, which she did.
Could you imagine making love in a castle that's hundreds of years old?
Her eyes lit up as she spoke.
Lying naked in a room where some king put it to his queen?
Or to his chambermaid.
There you go.
She held her glass up and we clinked them again. With my luck, I'd book the room that used to be the privy.
The privy?
The bathroom.
Oh, come on. What would be cooler than doing it in a castle?
How about on a beach? I said.
You've obviously never had sex on a beach.
I've never even been to a beach. Not one with an ocean attached to it.
You've never seen the ocean?
Never.
Oh, Joe, you have some living to do.
Well, that's the plan now that I'm about to have the means.
Then here's to Toke Talbert.
She raised her glass a third time and I raised mine. To the founder of the feast, I said, channeling a little Charles Dickens. This time, instead of a quick clink, Vicky moved her glass slowly in until the rim of her tumbler touched mine, holding it there before raising it to her lips. At that moment, the front door to the Snipes' Nest opened.
Well, look at this shit,
Harley Redding hollered, his words stumbling over a drunken tongue. Uncle Charlie stood next to Harley with a big grin slapped on his face. They walked toward us, Harley holding the edge of the bar to keep his balance. Charlie didn't seem to have the same issue. I turned in my seat and was about to stand to meet them, when Charlie nudged the younger man into a booth a few feet shy of my position. Harley fell into the booth and laughed. Charlie called out to Vicky.
A beer and a shot for me and my new friend here.
I ain't giving that drunk skunk nothing, she said.
Harley's head wobbled on his neck as he leaned out of the booth.
Who you got fuck round here to get a goddamn drink?
Then he burst into laughter and pointed at Vicky.
That's right.
He laughed so hard, he could barely get the words out.
I gotta fuck you.
Vicky turned to the kitchen, where Marv was working on my dinner, and whispered something to him. Apprising him of the situation would be my guess. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Charlie stand and make his way toward the bar. I didn't turn.
Could I get a couple shots of whiskey?
He asked politely. To that, Vicky raised an eyebrow and said,
I'm not serving Harley. He's too drunk already.
They're not for him. They're for me. Both of them.
Vicky kept her eyes trained on Charlie as she lifted a bottle and began to pour. The liquor in my blood warmed my chest and loosened my joints. The man leaning on the bar next to me was my uncle. No doubt about it anymore. And I felt compelled to tell him the good news.
Hey, Charlie, guess what?
I said as I turned in my seat.
Vicky and me, we were just celebrating. You know why?
I'm sure I don't care.
Come on, is that any way to talk to your nephew?
Still holding on to that fantasy, are you?
He said. That's the thing, I said, dropping my pretense that this would be a friendly conversation. It's not a fantasy. The DNA test came back. It's official. Toke was my dad, which also means that you're my uncle, and Angel's my sister. His fake smile skidded away. And to be honest, I'm not sure that I like the idea of you being her guardian. His eyes narrowed on me.
You stay out of my business,
he said.
You're an irresponsible hothead. You just stay the hell away from that girl.
The time had come to show my hard side. You know, Charlie, the other day, you said that you can find out some amazing things about a person if you know where to look. Turns out, you had a point.
Don't try bluffing me, kid. You're out of your league.
I looked him dead in the eye and said, Poppy Sanchez would beg to differ. He tried to hold his poker face, but the heat of his blood broke through the fake tan on his cheeks. A glimmer of recognition flashed behind his eyes before he said,
"Never heard of her."
Then he grabbed his two whiskeys, spilling some as he turned to rejoin Harley. Marv slid my burger basket through the window, calling out to Vicky as he did. I peeked over my shoulder to see Charlie leaning across his table, whispering something to Harley, who was drinking one of the whiskey shots. Then Harley looked at me, his eyes darting back and forth between me and Vicky.
"Here you go,"
Vicky said, placing my meal in front of me. I had just reached down the bar to grab some ketchup when I heard a groan in the floorboards behind me, but it was the sudden change of Vicky's expression that told me something was wrong. I turned in time to see Harley Redding bobbing his way toward me with his right arm cocked back and his teeth gritted in anger. Before I could say a word, he swung at my face. With my reflexes slowed by the whiskey, I didn't have time to block his punch, and his knuckles plowed into the side of my skull, sending a jolt down my spine. A flash of white exploded in my eyes, and then everything went black for a second. The power of his punch had knocked me off my bar stool, and I stumbled back, flailing at anything to keep me from falling to the floor. I caught the edge of one of the booths and grabbed the tabletop. The room tilted as I fought to stay on my feet. Harley stumbled back 20 feet and leaned against the bar, clutching his right hand to his chest. I did my best to blink away the blur in my vision as I pulled myself back up to standing. We were both wounded, but I had recovered well enough to take the offensive, and I charged at Harley. That's when Charlie jumped out of the booth. He grabbed me by the elbows, pinning my arms behind my back.
"Stop it!" Vicky yelled. "I'm calling the cops!"
"Fuck you, slut,"
Harley growled as he stumbled toward me. I tried to break free of Charlie, but the man had a firm grip on my arms. Harley let his wounded right hand fall limp to his side and used his left hand to give me a solid punch to my rib cage, knocking the wind out of me.
"Harley, no,"
Vicky yelled. He drew back and delivered a second punch to that exact same spot, and the right side of my body exploded in pain. I picked up my leg and kicked, but Harley stepped back, and my foot swung through dead air. I kept it cocked, waiting for Harley to come at me again. Then, Charlie let go of one of my elbows, freeing up his arm to wrap it around my neck. He jerked my head hard to the left, like he was trying to pop it off my shoulders. I turned my body to follow. Then he gave my neck a sharp yank to the right. I pushed against a table with my foot, knocking Charlie off balance. He fell to the floor, and I went down on top of him, his arm still around my throat, strangling me. I reached back and punched Charlie in the side of the head with my free hand. And that's when I saw Nathan Calder come bursting through the door. Charlie let me loose, and I rolled off of him, gasping for air and coughing. Harley tried to run past me, to escape out the back door, but I kicked his knee as he jumped over me, his legs folding together, sending him crashing to the floor on top of Charlie. Nathan was on him before he could get back to his feet. Nathan put Harley in an arm bar, pressing his face down to the floor.
"Damn it, Harley, stop struggling, or I'll have to tase you."
"He started it," Harley yelled. "I was defending myself."
"That's right," Charlie chimed in. "It was self-defense."
He pointed at me.
"This guy came at Harley. I was trying to break it up when you got here."
"You weren't trying to break up nothing," Vicky yelled. "You were in on it. I saw you."
"That's not true, deputy,"
Charlie said, a look of utter indignation on his face.
"I was breaking it up, I swear."
"Don't you believe him, Nathan," Vicky said.
She was out from behind the bar now, standing a few feet back from the scuffle.
"Harley attacked Joe, and this one," she pointed at Charlie. "He jumped in and tried to twist Joe's head off." "What are you doing, Nathan?" Harley yelled,
but his words were barely intelligible through his slur.
"I'm the victim here."
Nathan ratcheted handcuffs around Harley's wrists and stood him up. I'd managed to scoot out of the way to give Deputy Calder room to make his arrests. Charlie was on his feet, brushing dirt off of his nicely pressed khakis.
"Marv, did you see what happened?"
Nathan asked.
"I'm right here," I said. "I can tell you what happened."
"What about him, Marv?"
Marv was out of the kitchen now and leaning over the bar.
"Vicky told me that Harley was up to no good, but when the shit hit the fan, I was in the kitchen calling you guys."
Charlie thumped his finger into his chest.
I was trying to break it up. That's all I got to say.
That's bullshit, I said from my place on the floor.
I'm taking Harley to jail, Nathan said. You, he said, pointing at Charlie, should probably get on out of here.
Aren't you going to arrest him? I said. He was in on it.
I'll get a statement from you all later, Nathan said.
I'll be at the Caspian Inn, I said. Roommate. Then, more to myself, I added, I think I need to lie down. Nathan led Harley out the front door as Charlie slipped out the back.
Are you okay?
Vicky leaned down and put her hand on my shoulder. Breathing hurt like hell, but I said,
all things considered, I'm great.
Can you stand up?
Sure. I started to lift myself up, but a bolt of pain exploded in my chest, and I sat back down on the floor.
I think he bruised my rib.
Put your arm around my neck, she said, roping my left arm across her shoulders.
Marv, a hand, please.
Marv ambled out from behind the bar and hooked his wrist under my right armpit. Together they lifted me off the floor.
Good God, it hurt.
Yep, I said. He definitely bruised my rib.
They loosened their hold on me, and the room went blurry. I tipped back into the seat of the booth behind me as the lights in my head dimmed.
Hold on there, Marv said, grabbing my arm to keep me upright. You may have a concussion. Can you see my fingers?
I looked, and could see that he held two fingers up in a peace sign, but they were blurry. I tried to blink the blur away, but his fingers remained fuzzy.
Two fingers? I said. But everything's a little out of focus.
Vicky said.
We should probably get an EMT down here to take a look at you.
I'm all right. I just need to rest for a while. I stood up with the help of both Marv and Vicky. My knees didn't seem to lock as tightly as I would have liked, but I didn't fall.
I'll just go back to the motel. I'll be okay.
Marv said,
Vicky, you'd better help him back. Don't want him passing out in the street.
I think I can make it, I said.
That's what they all say, Marv replied. Right before they drop, I used to be a football coach. Let her walk you back.
Vicky wrapped her fingers around my elbow and led me out the front door of the Snipes Nest, the evening sunlight adding to the throbbing in my head. As my eyes adjusted, I could see Charlie sitting in his car in front of the bar, his eyes on me burning with fury. Chapter 36. After walking a block, my ribs still throbbed with pain, but my legs had regained some strength. I felt a little strange letting Vicky help me back to the motel, but then I would have missed a turn had she not been there to steer me.
See, she said, Marv was right to send me along.
I unlocked the door and said, I can take it from here.
Nonsense, she said. I'll stay until Nathan stops by to take your statement. I don't want you passing out.
She led me into the room, kicked the door closed with her foot, and sat me on the edge of the bed.
I had a bruised rib once. Even the smallest move can hurt like a bitch.
She started stacking all the pillows from both beds together against my headboard.
I'm really sorry about what Harley did, she said.
That wasn't your fault.
I'm not so sure.
She crawled onto the bed behind me and started fluffing the pillows, arranging them so that I could recline.
Harley and me dated back in high school, and I think he still has a thing for me. He can be a little crazy that way.
Charlie put him up to it. At least, that'd be my guess.
I doubt Harley Redding needed all that much encouragement. He can be a troublemaker. Plus, you're Toke's kid, and that thing with the GTO probably still burns him up.
Do you think Harley had anything to do with Toke's death? Vicky paused at that question, kneeling on the bed beside me, her hands squeezing her thighs as she contemplated that idea.
Harley? A killer?
You saw the way he came at me tonight.
Harley loses his temper, but I can't see him killing anyone.
Not even someone who swindled him out of his favorite car?
He did love that car, she said. But killing Toke over that? I can't see it.
She rolled off the bed and came around to my side.
We're going to ease you back. It's gonna hurt.
She wrapped her arms around my shoulders.
Try not to use your chest muscles. Just let me do the work.
I relaxed into her as much as I could, but the pain shot up my right side anyway. I stiffened, and she held me tighter, settling me into the pillows,
her long hair falling against my cheek. I could feel the strength of her hands on my back and the softness of her chest against mine. The smell of her perfume distracted me from the pain. I settled into the pillows, and she moved with me, the tension releasing from my chest with a final exhale. But she remained in that embrace, one arm around my shoulder, the other holding my head, her cheek pressed against my cheek. Then she gently slid her lips to mine and kissed me, and I let her. 1,000 shards ricocheted through my brain in that instant, half of them feeble rationales for why this was okay. I was hurt. This was compassion, nothing more. She was kissing me. I wasn't kissing her. I'd been drinking. I might have a concussion, so I wasn't thinking straight. It was only a kiss. But those were all lies, and I knew it. Her lips were soft and tasted of cinnamon gum. Her finger pressed against the back of my head, pulling me into her. The kiss was warm and gentle and lasted for only a few seconds before it was interrupted by a knock at the door. She pulled back an inch, her hair still tickling my face, an expression of disappointment in her eyes.
"Nathan,"
she whispered. I didn't say a word. I wouldn't have known what to say if I tried. Deep down, I was happy for Nathan's intrusion. He put an end to something that I couldn't, or at least didn't. I felt 100 ways of wrong at that moment. Vicky gave me a coy smile and got up to answer the door.
"Nathan, you have a terrible sense of..."
When she didn't finish her sentence, I looked at the door expecting to see Nathan Calder. Instead, I saw Lila standing in the open doorway, a look of confusion on her face. She went back and forth between Vicky and me, and her confusion fell away. In its place was hurt, profound and raw. Her eyes filled with tears as she turned and ran. I tried to get up, forgetting my bruised rib for a second, but the pain knocked me back down onto the pillows. I held still until I was able to breathe again. Then I rolled onto my side and off the bed, hobbling to the door in time to see her drive away. Chapter 37. I called Lila's phone twice on my drive back to St. Paul. She didn't answer, and honestly, I didn't expect her to. I had 2.5 hours behind the wheel to think about the coming conversation. The fog from Harley's punch had cleared from my head, and if I breathed in shallow breaths and leaned slightly to my right, I could keep the pain in my ribs from shouting. With that under control, I turned my attention to what I would say to Lila. She hadn't seen the kiss. I knew that. When Vicky opened the door, I was lying on the bed, and both Vicky and I were fully clothed. Lila would never know about the kiss unless I told her. "It's not what you think," I would tell her. "Nothing happened." But something did happen, and I knew it. I knew the taste of Vicky's lips and the feel of her breasts pressing against my chest as she pulled me deeper into that kiss. I knew the struggle of my words, yes and no, twisting up in my throat, with neither finding voice. I knew that telling Lila the truth would wound her in a way that could never be undone. I knew all these things, but I also knew that I would not lie to Lila. I paused in the hallway outside our apartment. Should I knock? It was my apartment too, after all. Yet I had violated something sacred, and entering without permission seemed suddenly wrong. I took a middle path. I knocked and opened the door at the same time, peeking my head in to see that she wasn't in the living room. "Lila?" No answer. Stepping into the dark apartment, I closed the door behind me and walked a few feet until I could see light cutting a line beneath the bedroom door. "Lila?" I called again, louder this time so that my entry into the bedroom would not startle her. I listened at the door and then knocked lightly. She didn't answer. I opened it to find her sitting on the bed, tucked up into a ball, her back against the headboard, her arms folded across her knees, and her face buried in her arms. I walked in slowly, the way one does when trying to not frighten a wild animal.
"Who is she?"
Lila didn't lift her head when she asked.
"She's nobody."
As soon as the words left my lips, I regretted saying them. All my practice on the drive up went out the window.
"Don't lie."
Lila lifted her head and looked at me, her eyes red from crying.
"She was in your room. She's not nobody.
You're right, I said. I'm sorry. I sat on the edge of the bed, being careful to keep some space between us. Her name is Vicky. She's a bartender down there. I got into a fight with one of the local boys tonight. Vicky walked me home. And that's all she did? Lila searched my eyes for the lie she was expecting. No, I said. That's not all. Lila's breath caught on something, and she paused to take in my words. The corners of her lips tugged downward, but she swallowed and pressed on. Did you screw her? No, I said. Did you kiss her? I tried to answer with words, but the most I could do was nod. What else? Nothing. I mean, she gave me a ride on her motorcycle one night, out to see the Hicks farm. We talked. And tonight, after the fight, she walked me home, and I shrugged. I stopped you? We just kissed the once. Do you really think that makes it better? Lila's hurt was turning to anger. I braced for more, but she pulled back. Her eyes had filled with tears again. I can't remember ever seeing Lila cry before, and to see it now carved a hole in my chest.
How could you do that to me? I don't understand.
I'm sorry, I whispered. It just...
Don't you dare say it just happened. Nothing like this just happens. Don't disrespect me like that.
No, that's not... I don't know what I meant.
I don't get it.
Tears flowed down her face now as she spoke.
All I needed from you was for you to be a good man. That's all I ever asked. You don't have to be Superman to make me happy. All you had to do was be a decent guy, and you couldn't do that. Did I ask too much? I honestly don't understand. Help me get it. Why do you need another woman?
I don't need another woman. I don't want anyone else. I love you, Lila. I don't know what happened. She and I were talking at the bar. We were kind of celebrating because the DNA results came back, and I'm definitely Toke's son. Lila, we're going to have a bunch of money in a few months.
You think I care about money?
Lila spat her words out with disgust, as if that notion repulsed her more than the kiss.
How could you think that of me? Who are you?
No, that's not what I meant. It's just that things have been stressful around here. If we had money...
So this is what I can expect when the going gets a little tough?
No.
I trusted you.
I actually came down to Buckley because I felt bad. I wanted to spend one night with you before I sit for the bar exam.
I was feeling bad about all the stuff you've been going through. I wanted you to know that I was there for you. I wanted to surprise you. And I find you with another woman.
I almost blurted out that all we did was kiss, but I stopped myself. She was right. This wasn't about a kiss. It didn't matter if it was a kiss or if it was more. Lila trusted me. She loved me and looked at me in a way that made me feel like I was the center of the world. I wondered now if she would ever look at me that way again.
I think you should go, she said.
Go? But... I had nothing to say that didn't sound trite and woefully lacking.
If you want to stay here at the apartment, I'll go. But I don't want to see you for a while. I don't want to hear from you, so don't call me.
Lila, I'm sorry. I don't want this.
Please, she said, burying her face in her hands. Don't make this harder than it is. I need to be alone. I have to get my mind back on passing the bar before I can think about us. Just go, please.
I walked to the door of our bedroom and stopped. I wanted to turn and fight for us. I didn't want to leave. But this was her call. I had no right to deny her request. Besides, I was pretty sure that if I forced the issue right now, it would end things between us. She needed me gone. Sometimes retreat is the best course if it leaves open a chance to return, even if that chance is a slim one. So I left. Part 2. Chapter 38. I'm lying on the hood of my car, my back reclined against my windshield, my knees bent, my fingers laced together on my stomach. It's a beautiful night, weather-wise. The lateness of the hour and the easy breeze coming from the north is enough to keep the mosquitoes at bay, and for now the throb of pain in my ribs is quiet. In the calm, the ghosts of the day resurrect themselves and move against the backdrop of the starry night. There are so many regrets circling around me, but the thing that haunts me the most is the echo of Lila's voice saying that all she ever asked of me was to be a decent man, and I couldn't even do that. When I left the apartment an hour and a half ago, I was a man adrift. I knew where I was going, yet I pretended that it was not my choice, as though I was being pulled here by a force outside of my own will, drawn to a place I once swore I would never again abide. Austin, Minnesota. I don't think I can ever go back to Buckley. It's unfair, I know, but I want to blame the town for my downfall. Try to blame Vicky, too. Sheer cowardice on my part. I tell myself that I have to stay far away from her, even though it was I who failed to mention Lila's name in any of our conversations. I saw Vicky's flirtations. I knew the smell of her perfume.